Welcome to Redefining AI, where we explore the cutting edge of artificial intelligence and its impact on society. Now, today we've got the privilege of welcoming a true pioneer in the world of artificial intelligence and data-driven business transformation. Our guest, Saul Rashidi, is a seasoned executive who has spent over a decade at the forefront of some of the most groundbreaking AI initiatives in the corporate world. Starting in 2011, Saul was part of the team that launched IBM's Watson, one of the earliest and most influential applications of AI technology. And since then, she's led more than 36 large-scale AI deployments, showcasing her expertise in ideation, conceptualization, design, and development of cutting-edge data and AI solutions. Now, this impressive resume includes serving as a C-suite member in several Fortune 100 and Fortune 500 companies, including roles as Chief Analytics Officer at Estee Lauder, Chief Data and Analytics Officer at Merck Pharmaceuticals, EVP and Chief Data Officer at Sony Music, and Chief Data and AI Officer at Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines. She's also been a senior partner leading the digital and innovation practice at Ernst & Young. Saul, she also wrote the book, Your AI Survival Guide, Lessons Learned from Real World AI Deployments. So it's with great pleasure that we welcome Saul to the show. Welcome to Redefining AI, Saul. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
So I've introduced you in my words. How would you introduce yourself?
I am the former Chief Analytics Officer, Chief Data Officer, Chief Data Analytics Officer, and Chief Data AI Officer for some wonderful, wonderful Fortune 100 and 500 companies. I was a practitioner that was fortunate enough to pivot into the executive world. I was the first to be assigned as Chief Data and AI Officer back in 2016. So I've held the role four times over, and I've definitely seen the evolutions, the ups, the downs, the pitfalls, and the realities of what it takes to actually deploy both data and AI capabilities at scale within large enterprises. So something that I think definitely is a unique aspect of my background. It also helps that I was with IBM and I helped them launch Watson in 2011. So I was there during the rise, and some call it the demise, but I owe a lot to IBM for giving me those lessons learned and the experience of what it's like to actually deploy AI capabilities at scale so early on and where we are today in the world. I was a former athlete. It's how, oddly enough, I got into the data space. I've had some phenomenal teams. We've established some patents together. I've just been really privileged to work across a variety of sectors and industries and been given these opportunities to not only lead and build teams. And it's been a wonderful ride to get here.
Admirable. It also sounds extremely exciting. One thing that caught my immediate curiosity is obviously that you were an athlete and that's how you got into AI.
I was an athlete that in my mid-20s just couldn't recover from the injuries. And I played rugby on the women's national team. And I decided to hang up my cleats and I took the job that no one wanted. And my joke is you know, there was a data engineering role that had been open for a commercial bank for a really long time. And I applied and I got it, even though I had no business doing it. So I left playing sports to become a data engineer. And I quickly realized that I found my tribe, my community. It was a space that I really loved. I'm more of a solutioner than anything else. I don't believe in no's. I believe in how's, and data engineering and analysis just really allowed me to do that. And that's how the whole thing kind of started. Very, very random.
And you mentioned, so in 2016, you were one of the first to hold the title Chief Data and AI Officer, correct?
Yeah.
So now we're in 2024, and this title is one that crops up in many different resumes. We see it featured, and I think it's also transformed in a different direction. I don't know if now it's an individual sort of Chief AI Officer or Chief Data Officer. There might be this segmentation. What's happened to the role per se in the development between 2016 and 2024?
So, you know, I think every 2-3 years, there's a new advent that gets a lot of attention, right? Whether it's the big data ecosystem or blockchain or Web 3.0 or metaverse, and it was data, now it's AI. I do think that this is going to stay. I think it's just going to be a component that's going to be embedded into every tool or application we use. I hope the role doesn't take the same form and shape as the Chief Data Officer, but I anticipate it would. You know, we've got a climate right now where we have a Chief Information Officer, a Chief Data Officer, a Chief Technology Officer, a Chief Analytics Officer, a Chief Digital Officer, and now they've added the Chief AI Officer. And even though the functions are fairly clear, the challenge that we're having is, where's the division of labor? Where does one role start and stop and the next starts and stops? Because they all have fundamentally have a dependency on infrastructure. They all fundamentally have a dependency on data. They all fundamentally have a difference on aggregating and putting together information so that they can create products and capabilities, but without the clarity of who owns what. And in some of my roles, you know, I've had to lean on the chief information officer for all infrastructure needs, and others I've owned it end to end. And the challenge becomes is the company or the enterprise never really defines it for you. You have to define it once you come in, but now you're trying to figure out what your job is with your peers as their jobs may evolve and change. And no one, of course, wants to give up headcount and no one wants to give up scope. It gets really, really tumultuous. So in comes a chief AI officer. And this is what I experienced earlier on. Well, what are they really responsible for? If it's strategy, no problem. If it's identifying use cases, no problem. But you're going to have a full-blown C-suite member be only responsible for strategy and requirements and not responsible for the execution of it. Well, that doesn't make sense. But now you insert execution, but there's a fundamental dependency on data. Well, so then do you rely on the chief data officer? Well, you have a dependency on infrastructure. Do you rely on the chief information officer? So now the execution becomes extremely laborious and complicated and complex because now you've got to collaborate with your peers that technically own, and I'm putting in air quotes, certain pieces of the equation that you are responsible for the outcome. So you have the responsibility, but you don't necessarily have 100% authority. And in comes the same demise or fate as the chief data officer. So I hope for the sake of companies and for anyone who takes on this role, they actually identify the division of labor earlier up front, so it has a higher chance of succeeding versus what I've experienced with the chief data officer role, where even if you look at the Gartner reports, average tenureship is 18 months and 66% of Fortune 500s were surveyed. And they said that only about 40% of them really understand the value of a chief data officer. And it's not because the individuals they've brought are incompetent. It's because when you work in an enterprise where the division of labor isn't clear, it just takes a lot longer to get things done. And there's too many cross-functional dependencies and you don't have ownership. So I would love to see this role be successful, but to do so, I think you need clarity in roles and where one thing starts and the next stops.
And would that be your main piece of advice? I mean, would it be your main piece of advice that you have to understand the division of labor to be able to succeed in this, what seems like a more complex matrix?
I think so, 100%, because it's not the competency. It's not the desire. It's not the motivation. It's how far do you have to lean on your peers to get things done? Because if I put myself in an empathetic role, the chief information officer role is extremely complicated these days. You're there to serve the business and technology is an enablement. But now you've added on other functional C-suites, and we also have a dependency on infrastructure, on production environments, on DevOps, on identity access management, on cloud ops, on Active Directory. One person can't service the needs of all these leaders, but yet one person, if they're historically known for owning all these areas, how do they scale? So I think clarifying the roles and responsibilities and how do you convert these strategies and use cases into fast action and what I call financial ROI, cultural ROI, relevancy ROI, depends on how quickly they can move. And if there's too many interdependencies with other peers, you can't move quickly.
Interesting. Let's move on to maybe talking about the experience that you've had then, because you wrote the book, The AI Survival Guide. And it's really about, from what we've understood, the lessons that you've learned from real world AI deployments. What inspired you to write this book in particular? And I imagine that obviously there's a core component of key lessons that you would like to share, and maybe some less than others, or some more than others, that you expect business leaders to really benefit and gain an understanding when reading your book.
So when ChatGPT came out in November 2022, and it took the world by storm in 2023, I started seeing a lot of quote-unquote AI experts come out into the market. And, you know, I've been in this space since 2011, and I know the brilliant researchers and the academics and the professors and those that have been responsible for deployment across these large big tech companies. And I'd never seen a surge of quote-unquote air experts that became experts in the past 6 months. And then if I looked at the trend in 2023, where a lot of things were going into POC, and I was looking at the stuff that was in POC, and I'm like, these things are going to stay in perpetual POC purgatory because these use cases can't scale. I realized that there were just a lot of companies that were getting bad advice from newish experts, if you will, but also from theories or rearticulations or research without real experience of the scraped knees and the bruised elbows and the lessons learned of what it takes to actually put something into production. Mm. And I was so busy doing the work, not really talking about the work, that when I got approached to write a book, I was like, you know what? I can't scale one-to-one, but I could scale one-to-many. So maybe this book can do a few things. For those who don't know much about AI, how to actually start it and incorporate it. So whether you're a steel manufacturing plant, or whether you're a hospital, or whether you own a $100 million digital agency firm, what are the areas of AI that are going to be pertinent to you? What to fear and what to embrace, and how to adopt it? I thought there was fundamentally just a lack of knowledge in that space. I think too, there are a lot of business leaders who are hearing about the hype and the art of the possible, but no one's really talking about gotchas. And I've lived those gotchas for 13 plus years. So I thought that there was a sense of reality that needed to be infused of like, what's fact versus what's really fiction. And then there are just some things that I was noticing of how I would see these decks of saying, oh, you can cut your workforce by 30%, which isn't true. Because quite frankly, any organization that's able to build bandwidth or capacity from productivity and efficiency gains, they just reallocate their staff to the backlog of stuff that's been building, or we reallocate them towards the growth verticals. We've never let anyone go. There was just a lot of crap that was out there. And so I thought it was a good time to just write about the realities. And like, even something of how to pick a use case or how to develop a strategy, an AI strategy. Are you going to be growth-based, efficiency-based, efficacy-based, productivity-based, or knowledge-based? And what's the difference between all five AI strategies? No one really knows how to talk about it, or I don't think they even know of it.
And who's responsible for, again, the AI strategy?
Well, so that's the thing. Usually what ends up happening is large enterprises, if they haven't assigned a chief AI officer, it's a committee, and then they bring in a management consulting firm, and then they work with all the executives to establish an AI strategy. But you can consult. If you haven't done, how are you able to bring in transparency and awareness of what is and isn't going to work for that culture with that maturity, with their business objectives? Every environment is very different. This isn't a like peanut butter spread type of approach. And so I think a lot of leaders were led down the wrong path in establishing strategies that just fundamentally weren't right for them. Or even the opportunity of picking a use case. Like, don't ever pick a use case based on business value. And it sounds so contradictory, but the fact of the matter is every use case has embedded business value, but that is not the number one determining factor, whether or not you can actually push it into production and see those financial gains that you'd anticipated. Well, how do you go about actually doing it? Like, people just weren't talking about that stuff. So I have just under 40 enterprise-grade applications in production still to this day. And I've messed up on a lot of them, but I've learned from a lot. So the book actually walks you through of like, if you're a newbie and a non-technologist, how do you even start? But if you're somewhat competent in the technology space and you don't want to be misled, what do you need to think about? So it's like real, real lessons learned from deployments versus theory being regurgitated. So, that's what I'd like to call is what's distinguishing the book. And I'm very fortunate. It's been out like only a month and a half and it hit bestseller already with pre-order.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. Yeah, it sounds extremely exciting. Yeah.
Thank you. I've had so much support. It's been one.
So if you were to summarize then the two components that you mentioned, what to fear and what to embrace, what is the number one element that organizations should possibly fear?
For some reason, there's a misconception. You cannot do AI without humans right now. And this is the thing they need to embrace and not fear. You cannot deploy any AI model, algorithm, foundational model, capability, widget, extension. I don't care what the capability is. No matter what, there must be a human in the loop. And I actually share some stories of where a human wasn't in the loop and where things went wrong. Because as remarkable as this capability is, it's not perfect and it doesn't have embedded critical thinking or common sense. It is purely learning from information that it was trained on. And sometimes not all information is correct. So it is remarkable and wonderful. However, it needs your critical thinking and your judgment and years of experience to determine if it's on the mark or off the mark. And there is always edits and tweaks that need to be made. So the thing that we fear most right now is incorrect. And we need to embrace the fact that we actually can't do AI without human eyeballs, human critical thinking, and common sense into the formula. There must always be a human in the loop at this point in time.
Yeah, we'd very much agree. I recently as well read a study, it was from BCG, and they also claimed that there's around, out of the evaluation that they did with the percentage of organisations that participated, about 40% of companies that are taking no AI action on generative AI initiatives. Does this surprise you? Because also there's a lot of statistics that, you know, companies are, I think it's like 4 times more likely than other companies to have increased their investment in digital and AI due to the emergence of generative AI. Like, how do you think generative AI and the emergence, as you spoke about briefly, how has that impacted this possible fear or desire to embrace AI?
I think there's definitely some could be a fear component, but to be honest with you, I know companies who haven't started down the AI path, and I applaud them. And the reason is because for some reason, firms are instituting this fear of, if you don't do it, you won't survive. That's not right. Like, there's still a lot to be discovered. And it's not that you're going to die, because it really depends on your industry as a whole and how much of a laggard that industry operates across all different industries and verticals. There's just so many components involved. But just because they haven't started doesn't mean they're necessarily late either. Sometimes it does take quite a bit of deliberation to understand what is the right way of introducing it. I think the other aspect of it is you have so many successful companies that, quite frankly, operate very inefficiently. And so just the basics around defining a business process, automating a business process, of which none of them are AI, will give them the gains that they are looking to achieve. So I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that companies still need to adopt. And if they're predominantly an industry or company that relies on what I call sneaker net, not the internet, so they do things manually and through relationships, there are other areas to tackle before you can see the financial gains from efficiency and productivity. You don't need AI to solve every problem. And I think that's another misnomer. Why hit a nail on the head with a sledgehammer when a hammer does the job? And so I think for those 40% that have not adopted or have not started the Gen AI path, more than likely, they're either in legacy-based industries, and so there is no imminent threat. Or two, there's other low-hanging fruit, like hitting a nail with a hammer versus a sledgehammer. So I think they're picking the right opportunities. Or three, they're just taking more time, because sometimes some cultures, depending on your risk exposure, requires you to measure 5 times before you cut once. So I think they'll eventually get there, but it's okay. Yeah. They didn't jump on it in the past year and a half.
No, I'm sure they will. I mean, our conversation has gone by extremely quickly. We're almost at the end of it. I'm trying to sort of ponder over which question to ask you as a closing question, which would be most beneficial to our audience as well. I think we'll look at the sort of human component, because we mentioned how important it is to have humans in the loop in this AI scenario at present. If you were to advise based on your experience, you know, you've got business leaders that are going about, you know, trying to assemble right teams to lead their AI initiatives. What mix of skills and expertise do you really think is ideal to get this equation correct and set themselves up for success?
I mean, I think most people are going to say, oh, you need engineers and developers and ML apps. I'm not going to go into the technical skills. I actually have a chapter in my book just focused on people. Mm. It's like the people are the project killers. It's not the technology. And I think there's two aspects. If you're building a team from scratch, I use what I call a skill-will matrix. They have the skill, they have the will, keep them on the project. If they have the skill, they don't have the will, get them off the project, because they will drag everyone else down. If they have the will but don't have the skill, they could be coachable and it could be their first deployment. They will learn because they're hungry and curious. And if they don't have the skill or will, they just don't belong in the project. But if you inherit a team, time and time again, I have interfaced with what I call the 10 AI archetypes: the naysayer, the curmudgeon, the cheerleader, the doer, the advocate, right? There's 10 classic character archetypes that consistently come across every single project I've had to lead, because they're either a team I've inherited or it's a team I have to work with cross-functionally. They sit in other teams and now the AI is now one of their strategic priorities. And without a doubt, you're going to get those 10 AI archetypes. So in the book, I actually walk through, it's like, even the curmudgeon or the naysayer who's like, nope, that's not going to work. Nope, that's not going to work because of this and this and this. And they're so negative. There's always a place and time to pull in individuals. And I go through these 10 archetypes. And in the case of, like, let's say the curmudgeon, who's very negative and just thinks this is baloney, you never want to bring them into the strategy or the mission process. You never want to bring them in when establishing use cases. You never want to bring them in when you're gathering requirements. But they absolutely serve a purpose when you need to vet out what you're proposing. Because they're so negative, they will tell you why each of these things won't work. And those are exactly the blind spots you need to be aware of. So you need people like that on the team. Don't bring them up front early, because they can actually demotivate and lower morale. But you need them to call out the blind spots and the areas and the assumptions that you're incorrect about in your use case development and design, because you're the first ones to spot it out. So your people are going to be your project makers or your project killers. And without going too much into it, I think it's the people you put together is everything.
Oh, excellent advice. I'd certainly agree with that. And it's something that I can resonate with as well. I think that it's like anything, you know, people make an organization and people certainly make up the right team to lead an organization's AI initiatives. Been wonderful today. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm sure that our listeners have also been able to profit from this wealth of knowledge that you shared with us today. So thank you very much.
It was a pleasure, Lauren. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I'd like to thank everyone else who's come on this journey with us today on Redefining AI. If you enjoyed the episode, then share it. Share it with your friend, share it with a team member, share it with a naysayer, or share it with your mum and your dad. Thank you.